Dr. Donald Warren, I'm the director of the Office of Native American Health at Sanford Health, and I'm a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. So I'm originally from South Dakota, but had spent most of my career in Arizona, and had worked with a lot of the tribes in the Southwest. And in the last 2.5 years, I moved back home to South Dakota to work with my local tribes there. And what I'm going to talk about is kind of a history of federal Indian policy and current policy issues as it relates to health disparities. And I really like the theme of our APHA conference this year, looking at social justice. And I think that social justice is an important arena to explore, even more so now, given the changes in our national political dynamics. But I think quite often the American Indian social justice issues have been largely ignored. I think most people are just not aware of our history. So again, no disclosures, no relationships to disclose. For this particular purpose. So what I'll do is go over issues of health law and policy as it relates to American Indians, and specifically American Indian health disparities and resource disparities, and how policy directly relates to our health disparities, and couch that in the discussion of social justice and Indian health, and then look at some policy coordination strategies. There are things that we can do moving forward to improve the health of our people. Well, one of the hats that I used to wear is I was on faculty at Arizona State University, the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. We're not allowed to just say College of Law anymore. We have to say the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. So if there's any spies out there, I did say the correct term. But I used to teach American Indian health law and policy at the law school. So I wasn't a lawyer, but I played one at work for 4 years. And the first question I'd ask my students is the following: do people have a legal right to health care in the United States? Are people born with a legal right to health care? And as we know, the answer to that question is no. We don't have a legal right to health care in this nation. We tried to do that this last couple of years, but unfortunately, we haven't gotten to that point yet. So there are some laws, like EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which basically states that if you are about to die or have a baby, you cannot be turned away from an emergency room. So we have that degree of safety net, but certainly EMTALA alone is not going to manage chronic diseases like diabetes or cancer. So people do not have a legal right to healthcare in this country, and that's for everyone except American Indians. As American Indians, we are the only population born with a legal right to healthcare, and most people don't realize that. And the basis for that is in treaties. The tribes exchanged vast amounts of land and natural resources for several social services, including housing, education, and healthcare. So our tribal leaders like to look at the Indian Health Service as the largest prepaid health plan in history. And it is not a handout. Think about how wealthy and powerful this nation is. And much of the wealth is due to its natural resources. And those are American Indian resources. And we didn't lose them in a war, we exchanged them for social services. Unfortunately, we're not getting a fair return on what we gave up for things like healthcare. Indian Health Service is terribly underfunded, and we'll talk about that. And I was at a budget consultation meeting in Arizona for Indian Health Service about 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the tribal leaders there put it very well. He said, if you want to get rid of the Indian Health Service, that's fine. Just give us our land back. But of course, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Now, interesting, we spend in this nation nearly $2.5 trillion a year on healthcare. Just an unbelievable amount of money spent on healthcare. $2.5 trillion. That's $2,500 billion spent on healthcare. It's an unbelievable amount of money. So in this nation, the way the system is set up is not well thought out. I mean, if someone gave you a budget of $2.5 trillion, would you come up with the system we have today? Well, of course not. What we have to remember is that $2.5 trillion is a lot of money. And the groups with the most political clout get the largest slice of that pie. Are the pharmaceutical industries doing okay? Are the hospital organizations typically doing okay? Is the biotechnology industry doing okay? Are the physician organizations doing okay? Well, you bet they are. The health insurance industry, they're doing just fine. What about American Indians? Have we had a lot of political clout historically? You basically need lots of votes or lots of money, and historically we haven't had much of either. So we get a much smaller slice of this pie. So if we're going to be involved in Indian healthcare, from a policy perspective, we have to be involved politically. We don't have any other choice, because political clout translates directly into how much resource that you get. Well, we know we have about 45 million uninsured that should go down with implementation of healthcare reform, but we have another 40 million or so underinsured people. And I look at the Indian Health Service user population, people who are depending on Indian Health Service, really as an underinsured population. We have access to some basic resources through Indian Health Service, but as we'll see, not nearly enough resources to meet our health needs. The graphic here on the left is right from the IHS website, and it shows the legal basis for federal services to American Indians and Alaska Natives. And the text on the right is actually one example of many hundreds of treaties that were signed between the tribal nations and the federal government. This happens to be one with the Potawatomi Nation in 1846. And I know it's in very fine print, but at the bottom of this page, it states the United States giving at the same time promise of all proper care and protection. Promise of all proper care and protection. Are we receiving all proper care? Not even close. And we'll go into that in a little bit more detail. This is also from the IHS website. Indian Health Service is the principal federal health care provider and health advocate for Indian people. And I would agree that they're the principal health care provider. But in truth, as an IHS employee, you are limited in the amount of advocacy you can do. You certainly can't lobby as a federal employee. So in truth, the principal health advocates need to be the tribes. The tribal leaders need to be the principal health advocates. And of course, IHS is the principal provider. This is from an article I wrote a few years ago on sustainability in healthcare. And it's trying to look at our health system in the most simplified terms possible. But essentially, there are four components. Health law and policy governs the other three. We have public health in the public sector, we have the medical industry, primarily in the private sector, and then of course research, which is funded by both public and private means. And I think all of us know inherently that we are at truly a market disadvantage in public health. Because the medical industry is like any other industry. It needs customers, right? And who are the customers for the medical industry? Well, it's sick people. So what if one day we got really good at preventing type 2 diabetes? And let's say over the next decade, we prevented 90% of the cases of type 2 diabetes in this country. That would be a victory for public health. But it would be a disaster for certain sectors of the healthcare industry, the medical industry. Think of the pharmaceutical companies whose business plans depend on increasing numbers of people with type 2 diabetes. Think of the dialysis centers that would eventually have to close down. Think of the diabetes specialists who would have to look for other places for customers or patients. So we have to recognize we're at a market disadvantage in public health as opposed to the medical industry. And there's market forces that keep people sick. If you look at what we spend on medical care versus what we spend on primary prevention, it's just dramatic how little we invest in preventing disease. And the problem is, nobody makes money by preventing disease, but plenty of people make a lot of money by treating disease. So we're at a market disadvantage. In the Indian Health Service, we're at an even bigger disadvantage. Our medical system is also in the public sector. So we don't have many opportunities to participate in the medical industry or medical system from a profit-making perspective. So our system is inherently developed to stay impoverished. And we need to look at opportunities to participate in the medical industry. So if we look at American Indian health policy issues, one is just the complexity of the health system in the US. All of us deal with things like JCO accreditation, or HIPAA compliance, of course. We're dealing with all of these types of issues in the US nationally, of course, but we have to deal with those issues in the Indian Health Service as well. But in addition to that, we have several other issues, like our unique political relationships with federal and state governments. And because we are sovereign nations as Indian tribes, we enter into lots of intergovernmental agreements with the state and with the nation. And unfortunately, the federal relationship with the states is quite different than the federal relationship with the tribes. And I think one of the most glaring examples of that was mentioned earlier with the block grant systems. You know, SAMHSA, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, does block grants for seriously mentally ill clients. All those block grants go to the states, and the tribes have to depend on the kindness of the state to determine whether or not they receive any of those funds. And in most states, unfortunately, because states' budgets are struggling as well, the states get those dollars. In South Dakota, for example, we have high rates of alcoholism, substance abuse, and suicide on our reservations. And the state of South Dakota is more than happy to use those numbers to justify their need for a bigger block grant. Then the money gets to the state and not a dime is spent in Indian Country. Talk about social injustice. So we have a unique relationship with the state, and if they choose to withhold those resources, that's exactly what they do. There's also the concept of trust responsibility and entitlement. And we know that the U.S. government has a trust responsibility to provide health services to American Indians, but our funding for Indian health service is not an entitlement program. So we're entitled to health care based on law, but we're funded as a discretionary program. So it's really at the president's discretion or at the discretion of Congress. So when we look at the budget, we have entitlement programs, we have the defense budget, then we have non-defense discretionary spending. And what is the Congress targeting to reduce the deficit? Non-defense discretionary spending. That's part of that's the IHS funding, that's CDC funding, that's NIH funding. So public health is really at a huge disadvantage here because we are the smallest pocket within the budget, but we're being targeted for reductions, unfortunately. Also, IHS has unique relationships with Medicaid and Medicare. When Indian Health Service bills Medicare, that's the only time in the federal government in which one federal agency is billing another federal agency for direct services. And we have all kinds of complexity built into that. There's also the concept of sovereignty and self-determination. There's public law 93-638. And in Indian Country, we've all heard the term 93-638. And actually, the word 638 has become a verb in Indian Country. What it basically means is that under this law, the tribes can take over the management of the hospitals and clinics from the Indian Health Service. So you'll hear tribes say that we 638'd our hospital, or we're going to 638 the clinic. It means we're basically taking advantage of this opportunity to manage locally the health services. And it's now more than 50% of the IHS budget goes to 638 contracts and compacts for tribal self-determination. Also, the unique nature of Indian Health Service, IHS, as a federal agency, we have to follow the same types of policies and procedures that the rest of the Department of Health and Human Services follows. So, for example, when we are contracting with vendors, we have to go to the lowest priced vendor every year or two when we're contracting for services. Now, if you're at the NIH and you're paying for test tubes, it probably doesn't matter where those test tubes come from. But within Indian Health Service for direct care, if we have to purchase services from the private sector, let's say a cardiology group or oncology group, if we have to go to different vendors each year, does that interrupt continuity of care? Well, you bet it does. And we deal with that every year or two when we're recontracting with new private sector vendors. Health disparities and resource disparities, I'll get into that a little bit later. And just going down to the last bullet point, a lack of accurate data and research issues. There's been a lot of reluctance on behalf of the tribes to participate in certain types of research projects, I think because historically the tribes haven't been treated as partners in the research process. And one of the outcomes of that is that we have limited participation in things like clinical trials. And it's something that we're trying to work on in South Dakota and other places as well. Well, let's look at the Indian health system. And this is kind of where Angela left off, is looking at the development of IHS in 1955. And at that time, IHS was moved from the Department of Interior to what was at the time the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which is now Department of Health and Human Services. And in 1955, the world of medicine was very different, wasn't it? That's before Medicare, before Medicaid, before HIPAA compliance, before medical subspecialization. And the world of medicine has evolved tremendously since 1955, and the IHS has not always kept up with that evolution in medical care. Well, like I had mentioned, Public Law 93-638, that it passed in 1975, and that was the new player back in the mid-1970s, was the tribal programs. And at that time, was the Indian Health Service happy and willing to give up control and money to the tribes? Well, no. There were actually a lot of documents created that were very paternalistic, that stated why tribes cannot and should not manage their own health systems. So there's a contentious relationship historically, but we've seen tremendous improvements over time. I think the relationship now between IHS and the tribal programs is better than it ever has been. Well, even though Medicaid law passed in the 1960s, it really wasn't until the last 15 to 20 years that Medicaid has been a participant in Indian health. And because we have such high rates of poverty, our largest source of third-party revenue is Medicaid. So even Medicare nationally is bigger. Medicaid is the main player for Indian country. And of course, each state is different. So we have a lot of complexity built into this system. And we have three levels of government, federal, tribal, and state, three separate health systems with IHS 638 programs and Medicaid programs. And this does have an impact on quality of care. So for example, when I was working in Arizona at a 638 facility, so it was tribally managed, if we were to diagnose cancer or suspect cancer, the first thing we would do is enroll them in Medicaid if they're eligible, and then we'd refer the patients to Phoenix Indian Medical Center, which had an oncology program. So suddenly one patient has engaged three separate health systems. Is there a case manager that overlaps all three systems? Unfortunately, no. So people get lost within this complex web of health systems, and we don't do an adequate job of treating disease as a result. And I think one of the telling statistics in the state of Arizona is that American Indians have lower overall cancer diagnoses, but we have the highest death rate from cancer, meaning we're not screening adequately, and we're diagnosing late, and we're not having access to all the technologies that we need. So that issue is not a biomedical issue. That's a public health issue. That's a policy issue. And clearly, bad policy kills people. Certainly in Indian country, it does. So this is looking at some of our health disparities. The top part of the table shows life expectancy. And you can see the disparity between the Aberdeen area, Indian Health Service, and the rest of the country is about 10 years in life expectancy. Now, life expectancy is how long you would expect someone to live who was born this year. So it's our best educated guess on how long someone will live. Whereas when you measure the age at death, it's an actual measurement. And in South Dakota, the median age at death is 81 for the general population, and it's 59 for American Indians in South Dakota. On some of our reservations, for example, where I'm from at Pine Ridge, the average age at death for men at Pine Ridge is 49. Isn't that remarkable? So we don't need to go overseas to find third world health conditions. It's right here. And unfortunately, this nation invests much more resources on third world health conditions while ignoring, largely ignoring, the health issues that we face right here in the United States. We haven't solved our health issues, but we're spending a lot of resources and energy around the world. And I applaud those efforts, but let's not ignore the indigenous people, the first Americans, that are suffering, in many cases, even worse than other nations. So why do we have such high rates of death? Most of it's in the preventable diseases arena. Nationally, we have a 208% greater death rate from diabetes, 526% greater death rate from alcoholism, unintentional injuries, about 150% greater, and nationally about a 60% greater death rate from suicide. And our infant mortality rates vary significantly around Indian country, but in the Aberdeen area where I work, the Dakotas, it's about double the national infant mortality rate. So we have disparities comparing IHS to the rest of the nation, but in the Great Plains, Aberdeen area of the IHS, it's even worse. So you can see diabetes death rates are much worse in IHS compared to the rest of the nation, but in the Aberdeen area of IHS, it's even worse than the rest of IHS. Same is true, unfortunately, for alcohol-related deaths, much worse in Aberdeen area relative to the rest of IHS. And one of the things that I've seen in literally hundreds of patients and in thousands of patient visits is this triad of diabetes with high rates of depression. I see a lot of depression in people with diabetes. I really think it should be considered a complication of diabetes because it is so common. And people self-medicate with alcohol. Does alcohol intake worsen your blood sugar and worsen your depression, which worsens your alcohol intake, which worsens your blood sugar and worsens your depression? People are on this vicious triad. And we could substitute just chronic disease with depression and self-medication. It might be alcohol, it might be substance abuse, it might be food. People are self-medicating, and we're not treating this in a very holistic way. And in fact, what we do nationally is we cut that patient in half, don't we? And we say diabetes and outpatient depression is a medical issue, But if you have major depression and need alcohol treatment, that's a behavioral health issue. Even our Medicaid systems in most states divide those dollars into two separate agencies. And what is the impact of that? Essentially pretending that these things are not linked together and not having case management that overlaps both sides of that line. And I think that if one wanted to create a system to fail, this is how you would do it. I think we've proven it. We need to look at things more holistically. Our ancestors certainly understood that very well. So very briefly, our demographics. There's in the 2000 census, over 2 million who are American Indian only, but if you look at American Indian and other races, about 4 million. About 60% of us live in urban areas, and there are over 560 federally recognized tribes. So most of us do not live in reservations. So well, going back a little bit to Angela's discussion and the history, well, let's talk about Indian country. Well, this was all Indian country at one time. And of course, we know about what happened with the 13 colonies. You may have heard of Amherst, Massachusetts, or Amherst College in Massachusetts, named after Lord Geoffrey Amherst. And he was a colonial governor who in the late 1600s ordered the distribution of blankets from a smallpox hospital to the local tribes in the Northeast. Most people don't know that history, but the first documented use of bioterrorism is our own colonial government. And it was very successful in wiping out a lot of the Northeastern tribes. And of course, the Trail of Tears, moving the Southeastern tribes to Oklahoma. The discovery of gold was not good for the California tribes, and essentially this is what we're left with. And there's a lot of loss associated with that. We've lost indigenous food systems, we've lost our places where we used to live and thrive, and now many of us live on reservations and in deep poverty. This is a map from the census website showing the concentration of American Indian population by county. Most of us are in the West. Ironically, there are 35 states with federally recognized tribes. So that means there are 15 states without federally recognized tribes, and therefore 30% of senators don't have Indians in their constituencies. Does that put us at a disadvantage politically? Well, you bet it does. And ironically, one of the states without any federally recognized tribes is Maryland, home of the Indian Health Service, ironically enough. So if we look at expenditures for healthcare, IHS about $2,100 per person per year, Medicaid about $5,000, Veterans Administration $5,200, Medicare about $7,600, and believe it or not, even in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, nearly $4,000 per person per year. So I wouldn't recommend it to my patients, but if they go to federal prison, they're going to have access to more healthcare resources than Indian Health Service. And who was born with a legal right to healthcare? Whether you're Indian or not, is this social justice? I mean, not even close. And if you look at the amount of money to fix that, it would be adding about $3 billion to the current $4 billion appropriation. The Department of Health and Human Services budget is over $800 billion. To essentially fix the IHS budget issues would just be a matter of a few tenths of 1% of the HHS budget. If that was moved into IHS, we'd solve it. That's budget dust, you know, that's within the margins of error for budgeting. But unfortunately, we've had great struggles getting to that point. In the interest of time, I'll just go through this very briefly and just state that essentially, we're investing much more resources in treating complications of diabetes and tertiary care, and not nearly enough resources in primary prevention. And that's true nationally, but it's also true in Indian Health Service. And one of the challenges that we face is that we need to coordinate our policy efforts. So for example, in health policy, if we're stating things like we need healthy food in the home and healthy food in the schools, if we're not adequately funding education, they can't pay for healthy food. The healthier food choices are more expensive. And even in economic development, I was working with one tribe where we were strongly advocating for breastfeeding. You know, one of the best ways to prevent diabetes in children is to breastfeed. Yet even the tribal workplaces were not allowing for breastfeeding in the workplace. So we have to look at this from a broader perspective and realize it's not just the health arena, but social policy, education policy, and economic development are all very important. So in terms of next steps, we need better lobbying and better advocacy at the federal level and the state level to improve funding and resources for our people. And I think that, unfortunately, if you look at the last bullet point, we have a more challenging political climate now because I think many of our newly elected officials are committed to cutting the non-defense discretionary budget. Well, that's cutting all of us. not just Indian Country, but CDC and other programs as well. I'd like to end with this photograph. It's actually one of my ancestors from Pine Ridge, and he's a medicine man. And what he's doing here is very different than what we see in the medical clinic these days, isn't it? You can see he's touching the patient, he's praying with the patient, and there's family and community participation in that healing process. Now, it might not be HIPAA compliant, but that's meaningful healthcare. And we used to address things in a more holistic way and understood that the health of the community has a direct impact on the health of the individuals. And without adequate resources, we cannot get to that point. But I think we have much to learn from our traditional approaches, recognizing that the health of our people is dependent on the work that we do in public health. And I'll end it there. Thank you all very much.